Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Well, hello there, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here. And of course, I'm the genius professor. I'm the greatest professor that ever lived. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about today in the show. Genius and greatest are these words tossed around in history all the time. We've done shows on Patton. We've done shows on MacArthur, all these sort of totemic, huge figures in history. And we're going to talk today about someone in American culture, Frank Lloyd Wright, who was thought of as a great genius, in fact, a god as architecture, and thought of himself in that way in many ways. Well, we're very fortunate to have with us architect Eric Oss, who's from Urban Design Associates, a great architectural firm. He's, of course, a member of the American Institute of Architects. And more importantly, he's one of the colossal buzzkillers in the Buzzkill Institute. His fees that he charges every month for his genius are enormous. They're bankrupting us, but they're worth it. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
We're talking about Frank Lloyd Wright because he is one of the most famous American architects, but we're wondering whether all of that's been exaggerated, whether a lot of myths. How did you come to sort of learn about Wright and study about him? And of course, you've lectured about him and all those other things, but where had you first exposed to Wright, if you will?
Well, Wright is one of those architects that I think he's kind of, you know, it's everywhere. And when you grow up, you know, wanting to be an architect, you know, certainly the first thing everybody points you to, your parents, your grandparents, your neighbors, they say, well, you really need to look at Frank Lloyd Wright. He's the greatest. He's the greatest architect of all time. I thought that, you know, I grew up in the Chicagoland area. I thought that maybe part of it was, you know, Wright had a very strong connection with Chicago. He grew up in Wisconsin on a farm. But, you know, the more you realize this is really national. This is a national phenomenon. And he was the architect for everyone. But when you dig a little deeper, it's interesting because, you know, you ask yourselves, you know, name another. And most people just really know Wright. He was the architect for the time and for all time.
And if they do know another American architect, it's probably Thomas Jefferson, for instance.
Probably, or their neighbor down the street. But
it's, wait a minute, you're my neighbor down the street.
Jefferson. I think he had a second job, which was president of the United States.
Oh, there was something like that. Something like that. Much less aesthetically pleasing, but certainly
right.
So then it started off partly by being from Chicago, but also partly because of your early interest in architecture.
Yeah, and he was everywhere, and I think it's surprising how many people know more than just his name. They know something about his work. They know about maybe the Prairie School, Falling Water, or the Guggenheim Museum. Mm-hmm. But they do know some kind of career highlights, and these were highlights that spanned over a really, really large career. It's actually quite shocking what a large career he had.
Because he's born just a couple of years after the Civil War ends, right?
That's right. I mean, he really bridged from when the United States started as a kind of agricultural country, largely agricultural country, and went all the way into what is now modern day America in 1959. So that's, I mean, it's incredible the kind of the time of which he all the things in which he crossed through his career.
Yeah, and he doesn't die until 1959, which is on the cusp of the 60s, the cusp of the time when, of course, your favorite professor was born in the early 60s. But the other thing that we've talked about a lot when we talk about this is, did he build himself up as a kind of a god? Was any of this sort of self-promotion, or was it all sort of accolades coming from afar and he was Mr. Modest in the corner?
Yeah, he really did build himself up. And it's interesting because when I went to architecture school, you know, you think you're going to be spending, you know, half your time on Wright and then the other half on everybody else.
Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson.
Wright in the fall semester, Thomas Jefferson in the spring semester.
Exactly. But when you dig into the subject a bit and you realize you're halfway through your first semester and you haven't even touched Wright, you realize that there's so much more out there in the world. So clearly, there's something to that. He was an absolutely incredible marketer. And when you dig down deep enough, you realize he probably was as good a marketer as he was an architect himself. That was really one of the things that he was brilliant about, was knowing how to position himself and knowing how to connect with people. And that's even a lesson for architects today, is we need to make sure we know how to connect with people. But Wright for sure was an excellent communicator and really seized moments whenever he could and took advantage of those moments.
Okay, we've got a couple of clips here I'd like to play. The first is from a very famous, very popular show back in the 50s and 60s called What's My Line? And Frank Lloyd Wright appears on What's My Line as the famous mystery guest. And the way he's introduced and then later described by the host of the show is part of this myth. And then the second clip is from a very famous, we'll get to that later as well, the Mike Wallace interviews, which again, he's referred to as the great, Wright is referred to as the great architect of the 20th century. So here we go down to the audio department of the Buzzkill Institute. We'll be right back.
But could it be that he's in something related, such as design or architecture, such as Frank Lloyd Wright?
Well, could it?
I guess it is.
Painting like design or architecture like Frank Lloyd Wright.
I think, Miss Dorothy, much has been revealed by the applause of the audience, and it would be very unfair to all of you to keep you in doubt any longer. Our guest is indeed Frank Lloyd Wright. Who, needless to say, and stands in the world's ranks of architects as among the very greatest of our day. Mr. Wright, I should know these things, because I know that as long as there is the ability in you to do it, you'll be designing and building. Have you built anything recently, or are you active now in some new designs?
Did you say active? I'm in harness. Just built a tower on the Western Prairies, the Price Tower. I wish you could see it. I'm quite pleased with it.
Good evening. What you're about to witness is an unrehearsed, uncensored interview. My name is Mike Wallace. The cigarette is Philip Morris.
The Mike Wallace Interview.
Tonight, we go after the story of one of the most extraordinary men of our time. You see him behind me? He's 88-year-old Frank Lloyd Wright, perhaps the greatest architect of the 20th century, and in the opinion of some, America's foremost social rebel. According to a story in Life magazine not many years back, fellow architects have called him everything from a great poet to an insupportable windbag. The clergy has deplored his morals, creditors have deplored his financial habits, politicians his opinions. And we'll get Frank Lloyd Wright's views on morals, politics, religion, and architecture in just a moment. My guest's opinions are not necessarily mine. The stations are my sponsors, Philip Morris Incorporated, but whether you agree or disagree, we feel sure that none will deny the right of these views to be broadcast. And now to our story. Admirers of Frank Lloyd Wright hail him as a man 100 years ahead of his time. Now 88 years old, he's still designing homes and buildings, which are revolutionary, including plans for a mile-high skyscraper for which he's had no buyers yet. But just as radical as Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, is Frank Lloyd Wright, the social critic.
Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers, and clearly he's famous and clearly he's well thought of because, of course, he's on TV talk shows, which is fascinating. Why is he so famous, and why did he become so famous, Eric?
Well, I think that came later in his life. I mean, this is a guy that had, you know, an incredible amount of scandal. He had, you know, and we'll talk about later about how much of a god he is. Even though he was a god, he in so many ways, where he positioned himself, he had a lot of very human mistakes. He was one of those architects that really embraced the media. He loved to be up front. He loved to be a showman. He loved to be in front of a camera, on the radio, and interviewed. And he loved talking about himself and about what he did. So if he said these things over and over again, you know, that people would start to believe him. And it's interesting because I've listened to your, you know, some of your shows in the past. Oh, sorry. Yeah, of course. I've listened to all your shows. But I remember one of your shows specifically, you mentioned that one of the things that a lot of these myths are contribute to a lot of these myths is that sometimes people drop the one of the off and then they just become the best. And Wright was quick to do that, just to take off one of the and just go straight into, yes, I was the greatest architect of all time. But so I think a lot of this stuff was that he embraced the media. But at the same time, I think the media was ready for somebody like him when you think about it, because he was one at that time, he was one of the very few architects that was American born, American trained, and talked about American architecture. That was something that is extremely unique. And he was kind of one man doing it. So it was one man versus the world, which you know America loves.
And he
loves that stuff.
In a lot of these interviews, he talks about individualism, mm-hmm. individual thinking, yes. right? So that
goes plays right into the American psyche. We're right after World War II. Mm-hmm. A lot of these other architects were either born in Europe, educated in Europe, or were always talking about what they called an international style of architecture was very popular at that time.
Oh,
and
okay.
that is something that, you know, at that time, a lot of American nationalism, Wright's the guy for everyone. And Wright was somebody they could put in front of the camera. And he had an outrageous ego and all of these things. And it was something that I think played right into everybody. And it's interesting because I remember my grandparents talking about seeing him on TV and in the media. And that's something that's very unique. Very few architects today are out in the media.
And my parents, especially my mother, the Duchess of Buskill, there was an LP, a long playing record, but younger Buskillers won't remember this, where he was interviewed by a panel of architects, and people bought it and listened to it as a spoken word record. And, you know, that doesn't seem to happen anymore. I can't imagine an architect nowadays who would be, you know, you'd have him in the record store.
That's right. And he had no problem on those to make these big claims. And, you know, a lot of architects are fearful to do that. He didn't mind saying I was the best. And, you know, he's always comparing himself to the great artists. He always put himself in the same sentence as Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci or right. Raphael. You know, he was always kind of comparing himself to the great, to the all-time greats. And another thing that might be a contributor too was the Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. You know, she clearly modeled portions of that character, not all of that character, on Wright.
He appears, if you will, in fiction.
Yes.
A very popular book in the 50s. And
very popular book, yeah. And,
okay.
And as Rourke, who, by the way, was such an individual, and one of the things about his book was that he was not a marketer. So interestingly, it was obviously she was taking part of his life, and that was one of Rourke's problems. But Wright understood that and never refuted his relationship to the book and did meet with Ayn Rand at the time. But, you know, he was never afraid to make those big claims. I am the greatest of all time. That was not necessarily a quote of his, but he never refuted it when it was offered to
him. Right. Because we don't want to have a quote or no quote episode where he doesn't say that and is credited as saying it. We never do that. But so in other words, he's not only embracing the media, he's not only appearing in fiction. Do we know, by the way, whether Ayn Rand and Wright knew each other? Were
they
friends?
They did. They did meet. She did visit him at Taliesin. And she did, when the movie came out for The Fountainhead, they did reach out to him to have him design the buildings that were going to be positioned as Rourke's buildings. And apparently, like Wright, you know, said he'd do it for some outrageous amount of money. And then the studio said no. But
we'll get
but
someone who can
apparently
copy
that.
Work
apparently,
well.
That's the story. But I know that there was an attempt to reach out to Wright to design those buildings. So, you know, he loved that opportunity for marketing, and he was certainly fully ready to embrace all that.
So is it any wonder that if he's appearing on Time magazine and he's mm-hmm. appearing in fiction, he's appearing on TV and no other architects are.
That's right.
He's seen as the fountainhead or the major American idol. He's attached to so many famous names, and mm-hmm. by the names, I mean, not individual architects, but names of schools and names of buildings. Mm-hmm. And people seem to know that. How did that come out? Did he promote that as well?
Well, I think a lot of it was that one of the things about his work, and this is where, you know, and I don't mean to push on his marketing. I think in some places it makes, when you dig in deep enough, you realize that it just makes him a more real person. But when you look at his architecture, it was at a very, very high contrast to that around it. So for example,
okay, right.
you know, I would say that probably the three big highlights of his career was, or the things that people recognize in, you know, when you run into somebody on the street, for example, most people can recognize Prairie School of Architecture.
Which looks like what?
And that was what is interesting is even today, it's easy to recognize. But at the time it was probably, you know, really, really in stark contrast to the things around it.
But it's not like... It's not necessarily the ranch house or things like that, or is it a little bit like that?
It inspired the ranch house for sure. And one of the things he did is he looked at the roofs, which were always very steep, and he flattened them.
Okay.
And then, you know, a lot at the time, there was a lot of very, very tall ceilings. He brought the ceilings down.
Right.
He eliminated basements and he put the house down on the ground. And it was about kind of embracing the landscape. What's interesting about this, and I think this is something that you see in design a lot of times, is that he actually made the houses much more affordable in that way. You can see, think about the amount of materials.
Oh, sure, yeah, think about it, yeah.
Yeah, so he was able to put money into other things, but at the same time, he was able to deliver a house for the masses, for everyone. So people tended to gravitate to that. And there was another thing about, I think, about the Prairie School of Architecture is that it was very much about single-family residential houses. And people, you know, everybody, you know, so many people know, either they live in a single-family house or they, you know, see it on TV or they know people, you know, obviously you know people that do. You know, it's something that's where people live. You connect to that. So it's not like he was designing industrial warehouses, you know, like Albert Kahn or, you know, or whatever. He was designing something that an everyday person could connect to. So naturally they think, wow, this is really an inventive way somebody was living. I can take advantage of that.
Well, and I remember that to a certain degree because although the Duchess wasn't born in suburban Chicago, she grew up there and we would often take drives and she would point out, oh, that's a Wright house. Mm-hmm. We were to Oakbrook or Hinsdale. Oh, that's a Wright house. And that was a very, very big deal. And I imagine that buying a Wright house and living in a Wright house was a huge status symbol.
It wasn't. And people, it's funny because everybody knows if there is a Wright building and when we fly somewhere to do work or something like that, it's amazing because people will oftentimes be quick to point out, oh, and there's a Frank Lloyd right up the hill if you go take a look. you know, everybody knows where the Wright house was. And I think it's interesting that contrast because, you know, at that time, you know, everything was about ornamentation and putting more on a building.
Right, right.
And it's a little bit like, you know, Wright's, and this is a little bit of a design, is, you know, he pivoted and did something very, very different. And by stripping things a lot cleaner and trimming things down, it's a little bit like bell bottoms. You know, there's a point where bell bottoms can't get any wider. You know, you got to go down to the narrow pants, you know. So that's what he did, is he put something that's very, very different than things out there. And that way it got very recognizable.
Yeah, well, now wait a minute. I lived through the 70s, and I remember some pretty wide bell bottoms. But I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, so that's very important because, of course, that's, as you say, single family homes, and almost nobody in architectural history, anyways, remembered as a home builder. Not very few people. What about his grand? And then he becomes known as that.
Yeah.
For that. What about his grander buildings, his public buildings? What are some of the iconic ones people will remember or know?
Well, the big one I think would probably be the Guggenheim Museum is probably the most recognizable. It's right in the middle of New York. It's very much different than its context. Mm-hmm. And it's a very imaginative building. The whole building has a very interesting history because it was something that he chased for a long time. And going back to even his career, his early career as a residential architect, he knew that in order to be really famous, he needed something big. It seems like the more you read, you can tell that Wright really firmly believed and really wanted to have a legacy of being the greatest architect of all time. And in order to do that, you need to have public buildings. You need to have buildings of really significance that are right in the center of the action. And for him to have a building, you know, in New York, on Central Park, was really the dream commission for him. Interestingly, it's really one of the last buildings he worked on.
Oh, right. And it is very, very different from everything else that's in that area. I've always loved it. And my mother took me there when I was little. And every time we go back to New York, we go there. And I think it's very distinctive. We've got pictures on the website. In the Mike Wallace interview, for instance, that we've talked about, and we'll hear some clips from later, Mike Wallace mentions this idea that Wright was planning a mile-high skyscraper but couldn't find a buyer for it. Now, why on earth no one would want to invest in a mile-high skyscraper is beyond me. But was this actually true?
He did. And it's funny, you know, this is another one where Wright, you know, probably another example of his marketing, you know, you know, it's not a 5,000 foot tall skyscraper. It's 1 mile, you know, I mean, it's like picking that, you know, he really was picking something that everybody would remember. Doing something, you know, outrageous and making those kinds of things are ways to really, captures people's imagination. And he knew that's what, you know, that's what people wanted to do. It was part of that thirst for something big, something, you know, extremely monumental. He did have, not only did he get a lot of projects built, but he had a lot of unrealized projects, a lot of projects that never did get built. And part of that was because he had the fellowship to do it. He had, you know, all these people ready to go to work on things, and he had that opportunity.
Oh, okay. And we'll explain the fellowship a little bit later. That's absolutely a fascinating thing. So you're saying that the marketing is very important. Is that the thing that sort of, you know, makes him different from other architects? Is that why we know him as such a famous and genius architect?
Yeah, and I think that's important because it really was, when you fundamentally break it down, it seems to me that, and when you put all the material together, he was as good a marketer as he was an architect. And not to take away anything from his architecture, it just makes him more real and a more real person.
Yeah, and we want to stress, of course, that it's not just us here at the Institute that are saying this, not just Eric saying this, but this is sort of the general flow of interpretive opinion among architectural historians, right?
Right.
It's not as if you walk into a study art history or an architectural history and you have to, you're assigned 50 books about Frank Lloyd Wright and mm-hmm. 2 books about everybody else. The critics and historians and interpreters of architecture will say that he's as much a marketer as anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think he was able to, in many ways, we're left with his legacy of being so great, was because he was able to overcome so many of his weaknesses, and being able to kind of erase them from memory. This is, people have their flaws, and it's interesting because, and maybe these all play into it, but I think that probably the American public would not be as interested in if there was a lot of shades of gray there. You know, people are interested in kind of people that have high contrast components to it. So this is a guy that had these incredible works of brilliance, and then he also had these incredible falls from grace where he, it's very unfortunate. He, locked up his studio one day when he was working on the Prairie School of Architecture, ran away with his client's wife, moved off to Europe, and she became his illustrator. That's Mama Cheney. Uh-huh. And just moved on with his life, left his debts behind. That was actually went right into the Chicago Tribune. That was front page news. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright, famous or well-known, residential architect from Oak Park, leaves his family and moves on. And so he definitely was out in the news, sometimes in a very positive light, but sometimes in a very negative light.
But of course, gods and geniuses in many ways can do that and get away with it, right?
Yeah. And I think part of that is
I should say gods and geniuses can sometimes get away with that, correct? Because every time we say right, it sounds as if we're saying right with a W. So, go ahead.
That's right. And I think that's where he really did position himself. He had to position himself as a god. He never used the word god. It's not written down anywhere. And obviously he was very human. But he really did position himself as a master in order to compensate for those weaknesses and to move things on.
And we've got another, probably the closest audio clip of him saying that in this Mike Wallace interview, where he talks about not being a god specifically, but he talks about being one of the greatest architects. And in fact, he even raises the question of arrogance. So let's listen to that clip and we'll come back and talk more about it.
You said many years ago that you would someday be the greatest architect of the 20th century. Have you reached your goal?
Well, now I think I never said it.
Well, I've done a considerable amount of reading by you and about you this week, and I don't think there's a good deal of doubt about the fact that over the years you have said it not once, but many times. Maybe in that not that specific form.
You know, I may not have said it, Mike, but I may have felt it. Mm-hmm.
You do feel it?
But it's so unbecoming to say it that I should have been careful about it. Mm-hmm. I'm not as crude as I'm generally reported to be, I believe, like this matter of arrogance. Now, what is arrogance?
What is arrogance?
Arrogance is something a man possesses on the surface to defend the fact that he hasn't got the thing that he pretends to have.
Arrogance,
it's a bluff, in other words.
Arrogance can sometimes be a shell to protect the inner man, too, can it not, even though that inner man has a good deal?
Well, it's a pretty brittle shell. I've been accused of saying I was the greatest architect in the world, and if I had said so, I don't think it would be very arrogant, because I don't believe there are many, if any. For 500 years, what we call architecture has been phony.
Phony in what sense?
In the sense that it was not innate, it wasn't organic, it didn't have the character of nature.
All right, we're back up here on the interview floor of the Buzzkill Institute. So was Wright not as good as he says he was, or not as good as he thought he was?
No, Wright was there were a lot of great architects practicing in that time. Mm-hmm. And there were a few, there were some several, I would say probably ones that would be equivalent of masters. And he was certainly one of those architects. He absolutely deserved a credit for being a great inventor. And that was one of the things he was always pushing, was invention. And he certainly was one of those architects that went out that really had people rethinking, and he was constantly pushing the envelope. Interestingly, he kind of has some revisionist history in some of his marketing. Like, for example, he made a claim that, I challenge anyone to find something that I didn't do first, any of the inventions of modern architecture. And it's funny, because when you look back, you know, there were some things that, other architects, like, for example, Adolf Loos came out with a book in 1913 called Ornamentation and Crime. You know,
crime.
And then, sure enough, you know, Wright's work from the 50s looks more like Loos's from the 1913 in terms of its kind of austerity and things like that. But so Wright was certainly deserved a lot, and deserved a lot of that credit. But I think it was one of the things that was most interesting about what he was doing is he was really pushing invention in architecture at a time when it was ready for invention. So he deserves that place in the world there.
So then what are the myths involved with Frank Lloyd Wright? Everyone at the time seems to be talking about him being a great marketer, or at least being on new media and things like that, which, as you say, is mm-hmm. not a crime necessarily. Yeah. But why do we have these other bigger myths?
Yeah, and I think this connects into his component of as an inventor, as he was always pushing the envelope, which also meant he was pushing himself with the engineers, which is kind of one of his interesting myths also, where you can mm-hmm. kind of find, there's a lot of people that will claim that Wright was one of the greatest engineers of all time, you know, and that he was really a great engineer. And I even remember, you know, my mom as a kid, my mom saying, you know, Wright was really known for great engineer, you know, where did a lot of those things come from? And I think it's part of I think it really is that Wright didn't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Oh, that never happens in history.
Right. So, I think one story that I think is an interesting one that has been there, it got up some news in maybe the late 90s. There was a little bit of research on this. And this is a story that's been, kind of built up over many, many years, was Wright's Imperial Hotel.
The Imperial Hotel in
Tokyo. So when Wright closed up his shop and moved to Europe, he ran off with his wife's with the wife of his client, as I mentioned. When he came back, he really knew, and we talked about this a minute ago, he needed big buildings. He needed buildings of scale. So he was really excited when the Japanese investor group approached him about the idea of building a Western hotel in Tokyo in the 1920s.
Oh, okay.
So he worked on this project for about 6 years of his career. And one of the issues that he knew he needed to deal with was earthquakes. And that's something that, you know, everybody faces in Tokyo. And interestingly enough, just as an architect, I'll mention this, that's an interesting kind of food for thought, is that of all the natural disasters, earthquakes are the one that is really an architectural problem. You know, I mean, there's only so much you can do about a hurricane, only so much you can do about a tornado, a flood, or whatever. But if you're in an earthquake, you want to be out of a building.
Yeah, that's right.
So don't be anything an architect created during an earthquake. For that reason, now that one of the things that is towards the very end of construction, there was in the 1923 earthquake in Tokyo, 140,000 people died. I mean,
nobody knows. No one in the West ever hears about this, or rarely hears about it.
Catastrophic. I mean, you think of it, it's just like wiping a city out. We kind of have a very short memory, and when we do have disasters, not to kind of diminish their importance, this was of absolutely significant major proportions. So Wright, of course, looking to capitalize on this opportunity, you know, kept apparently the research that a student, a fellow student had done when I was in grad school, that was that he had actually gone down to the LA Times, was consistently going down to the LA Times after the earthquake, have you heard about my hotel? Have you heard about my hotel?
He so, wanted to find out whether the hotel, from the news, whether it had been damaged.
Whether it had been damaged.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that Wright, going back to this, and Wright was very disparaging of engineers. He would always say, you know, show me a good engineer. He was very, very, he was always making comments in the press about the lack of inventive engineers. Now, that may have been possible at the time that there were a lot of engineers that were not willing to go along with his invention, but certainly, and he was probably going on a lot of instinct, and he was really pushing engineers to the limit, but he did start to think of himself and position himself as a great engineer. And one of the things that he did with the Imperial Hotel is he created a series of kind of modules to allow the building to rock with the seismic vibrations of the earth. And that particular hotel, they had chosen a site that had a very soil that was not very stable. So it created a whole series of complications. So Wright was consistently looking for a telegram that would give him some sense of what was going on with his hotel. And sure enough, apparently he received a telegram that said, hotel stands undamaged as a monument to your genius. Congratulations. Yeah, so there was a telegram that was sent by a gentleman named Akura, who coincidentally, by the way, was an investor in the hotel.
Oh.
And the telegram said, hotel stands undamaged as a monument to your genius. Congratulations. So Wright gets a telegram, and of course, this ends up in the newspapers. But what's fascinating is, sure enough, Akura was an investor in the hotel. And now when somebody has gone back and actually done the research, and you can find a lot of this online. There's actually a book out, a paper that was written, Frank Lloyd Wright's Imperial Hotel, A Seismic Reevaluation. Apparently the hotel actually did receive some damage. It wasn't even in the highest category of safest buildings after the earthquake. It actually received a kind of second category. So it did have some damage. It did stand, it did make it through.
Yeah.
But the idea that it was actually undamaged, and interestingly enough, I think a year or so ago, I got a chance to see, there was a Ken Burns special.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, there was a very long quote in that particular passage where it talked about, and I don't even know who wrote it, but he said, you know, that the telegram apparently, or some sort of message to Wright, said, our architects are fools. They design in steel and all this, and all of our buildings have fallen down. But, you know, and he kind of, you know, you can listen to the quote in the Ken Burns special. And sure enough, it really didn't happen. So, who knows whether or not Wright, you know, it stands to question whether or not Wright was involved in this. But sure enough, he wanted to capitalize on that as positioning himself as a great engineer. It's interesting because the myth making kind of continues when you even listen to Ken Burns episodes. They build on that same myth that the Imperial Hotel was not damaged and that it made through successfully when it really did.
So this
it did have some damage.
This is the Ken Burns special that he did on Frank Lloyd Wright. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
But it turns out that this is not true, that there was damage or that it was not built to totally withstand an earthquake.
It did make it through as a full structure, but yes, it did have some damage to it. But the fact that Wright, it's interesting how Wright capitalized on that and really tried to make it position it that he had done something right. And there in this paper, the seismic evaluation, they wonder whether or not some of the things that Wright did actually exaggerated some of the damage. So what I guess I'm getting to is that, you know, Wright was very quick to take credit for things that really didn't happen.
So, and what we're also saying here is that there are a lot of complications to this story that don't make this simple cut and dried, as the only building in Tokyo that survived was the Frank Lloyd building.
That's
and
right.
He provides shelter for everyone who was displaced by it.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true.
Well, Buzzkillers, as you know, what's not complicated is our sponsorship relationship with Harry's Razors, and we need to hear from them now. So down to the sponsorship department at the Institute, and we'll be back in a minute. I know you can't see me, Buzzkillers, down here in the sponsorship department at the Institute, but I assure you that I look and I feel fantastic. That's because I use Harry's Razors to fuzz kill unsightly stubble and save time and money at the same time, all at the same time. You know the history. Hundreds of years. One or two rip-off razor companies have had you at their mercy. Well, Harry's has come along to change all that. Two great guys, two buzz killers, Jeff and Andy, founded Harry's to stop this centuries-long problem. They decided to cut out the middleman. They bought their own razor factory company in Germany.
They make their blades themselves, and they ship them to you at $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more you pay at the drugstore. And of course, the blades are much more high quality because Jeff and Andy can control it. You know how much I love the blades. Soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide, a weighted, ergonomically designed, and an ergonomically designed in a way that Frank Lloyd Wright would have loved. Textured handle for more control, lubricating strip that helps things go smoothly as you shave, and of course the turner blade that Lincoln and all sorts of prominent people in history have used for those hard-to-reach places. Not only that, when you have a membership with Harry's, they mail them right to you on the regular schedule that you set up, so you're never left in the rough. And Harry's has a special offer just for you listeners, just for you buzzkillers. If you go to harrys.com and enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout, you'll get a great razor, 5-blade cartridge, shaving gel, and the post-shave balm for free. You just pay a little bit for the shipping. It's $3. It's nothing for a great deal. You set up your own membership. You set up your own schedule. You'll look great, and your face will feel great all day, even if you're only heard and not seen, like me. Now, back up to our interview with Eric Ost. Okay, we're back. And Eric, you talked about this huge building in Tokyo, the Imperial Hotel. But also, as we talked about earlier in the show, Frank Lloyd Wright is extremely famous for the single family home. What are some of the myths that grew up around his innovations or his designs of those types of buildings?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it is funny because he definitely was responsible for some innovations that we know today, but not as many as are out there or kind of in the news and kind of the myths that seem to grow. I remember as a kid, I remember hearing a lot of people talk about that he was responsible for so many innovations. In fact, I've heard it several times, and I can't remember where, that he was responsible for as many as 1,000 innovations to the single family home.
1,000?
Yeah, I can't even think of 1,000. I find it funny because I can't even think of 1,000 components to my own house, like let alone to the single innovations of the single family home. So I think this kind of goes back to the fact that he was able to have some strong contrast to the things around it. He certainly, some things that people might recognize, and I think this connects right into kind of where, as we mentioned briefly, ranch houses earlier in the show, is that the idea of kind of lowering the roof pitch to kind of a more flat roof look, kind of more of the one-story house look, and the no basement of the kind of, that was something that, and he was very, very, very much interested in what they called the Usonian house, and really creating the house for the every man. For every person. And that's something that I think is interesting, because when you start to connect a design theory with economy, and you see this over and over again in history, then that's when all of a sudden something really takes off. And some people sometimes forget that if you can kind of intersect it with kind of good business sense. So people were able to replicate a Wright-like house over and over and over again. And it wasn't necessarily, I think, Wright is very quick to take credit for the ranch house. And at the same time, in the press, and when you do some reading, he also was very disparaging of the design at the same time. So he was kind of do a little bit of both. But the people that really took Wright's idea of the single family home and something that everyone can afford was really production builders are the ones that really scaled that up to the context of, and a lot of times you can think back to California houses of the 50s and things like that, that had that kind of horizontal look and ranch house look, was really a lot of that, maybe the kind of Petri dish was from Wright. And then they were the ones that were able to scale that up to a production context. Wright tends to kind of quickly take credit for a lot of the things that go on in the suburbs, but certainly he created a kind of inspiration that was intersected again with good business sense and affordability.
So that brings us to another big myth, that he invented the suburb.
Yeah, and this one I find very entertaining, because it's kind of like cutting from the back of the line and like finding your way up to the front of the line. Wright was very right again. It's when you go back in his history, he was not real popular in the cities. He was kind of chased out of Chicago for some of his scandals that he had, personal scandals. He really had real trouble keeping a practice going in the context of a large city. And I think in some ways he probably enjoyed that separation and where he ended up practicing, which was Spring Green, Wisconsin, which is out in the landscape. So at the same time,
a suburb of Milwaukee. Do we know?
It's southern Wisconsin, and it was really close to his home, and that was where he really based his practice. But so he wanted to sell the idea of living in the landscape, and that was very much, again, probably when you think back on the context, that was the right way to something that people would really be interested in. I mean, you and I can remember, we're old enough to remember what the smell of a lot of cars with burning regular gas was like.
Oh yeah. Oh, the elimination of regular gas, a high octane gas, and smoking have been the two biggest olfactory changes in our lifetime by far.
Absolutely. And so the cities had a lot of other fundamental problems going on. They were not able to handle a lot of cars, which were starting to grow at that time. And there were a lot of fundamental problems in cities. And people were just, and cities kind of grew organically up until then. And all of a sudden now, cities were looking at, people were starting to look at cities with a little bit of some problems. Now, there were people that were making, philosophical ideas about living in railroad suburbs and living outside the city as early as the turn of the 20th century. And Wright's, work and a lot of his documentation and the kind of his polemics were kind of late 30s, in 35 and things like that. And he had what he considered his Broadacre City model. Hilariously, by the way, his Broadacre City was run by an architect, so it was probably due from the start. So the idea of that really being a real workable model was kind of flawed from the start.
Yeah, because also a lot of those Chicago suburbs, Oak Park and Oak Brook and all those things, maybe not Oak Brook, but Hinsdale, those lines had been laid before the railway lines had been laid before Wright was working. So he certainly didn't invent those places.
Yeah, and the railroad suburb was something that back in that time, a lot of railroads were built ahead of the development. So it was actually like a kind of a business development, tool in order to kind of assist with land speculation. So and that similarly started happening with road construction and highways. Now, Wright was one thing you can say is that Wright was very, very interested in automobile suburbs.
Right.
And it's funny because it really goes back to some of his fundamental principles. When you look at his early houses, he always had that little nook by the fireplace and he had inscriptions above the fire. And this was the place where you would bring people together and your family would really coalesce around the fire. That was the hearth, and that was something that was really strong. So Wright was very, very interested in kind of bringing that idea of the American family together. Interestingly enough, Wright
he's not exactly the big family man.
Yeah, he was not the big family man, and he had a very dysfunctional upbringing. He was he talks a lot in his autobiography about his fights with his father and things like that. So there are a lot of speculation that maybe his fascination with the family was because he was missing something. I think, actually, when you go back to the marketing, I think he realized that it connected with his audience. But interestingly enough, he did have some writing later in his career that he felt like the automobile wasn't a chance for people to get together in a car and, be away from all, distractions and actually able to work, be together as a family.
And the stench in the crowd of the cities. And
exactly.
Like that.
And it's funny, nowadays with so much traffic, some people feel a little bit imprisoned by the idea of being stuck in a car is probably not the greatest way to spend time with a family.
Well, we're old enough to remember. I certainly remember going for a family drive was a thing. Nobody does that anymore because you have to drive so much as a part of your regular life. You're sick of it. But going for a Sunday drive was a little entertainment.
And that was something that was kind of like the American way. I mean, people felt like it was an American right. I think, as we move forward, it's interesting about how people are going to think about their cars again, and maybe there'll be something to replace it. But Wright was very quick to jump on the automobile suburb for sure. But the idea of the suburb and living in the country and living at those densities was certainly something that was out there quite a bit already.
But I think what also is so fascinating is something you told me and then something I found in this Mike Wallace interview is this idea, or Frank Wright's idea, that he could then use his ideas to change the country.
Yes. Yeah. It is interesting. In that Mike Wallace interview, you mentioned it, he very proudly claims that, with 15 years, he could rebuild the entire the entire country, you know, and again, that's where we're making big claims like that at a very ambitious time, is something that is, you know, kind of right in there, for everyone. So and people could really grab onto that.
And let's hear him. We're going to play you an exact clip because play you the exact clip, because not only does he say this so directly and so forcefully to Mike Wallace, but he says it with a very calm confidence that says to me, this is not just, maybe it is marketing, but it also is marketing to his own head, because he firmly believes it. So again, here he is after telling Mike Wallace he could rebuild the nation.
I understand that last week, in all seriousness, you said, if I had another 15 years to work, I could rebuild this entire country. I could change the nation.
I did say that. And it's true. Having had now the experience going with the building of 769 buildings, it's quite easy for me to shake them out of my sleeve, and it's amazing what I could do for this country. And some magazine has offered me the whole magazine if I design a new capital for the country. It ought to be done.
Okay, well, there you have it from the man himself. Now, Eric, could he really have ever done this?
Well, you know, and that is, again, where Wright is doing quite the sales pitch there. you know, and I think that's where it's interesting, where you start separating the world of what architecture is and the world of city design and city planning. When you're doing something at such a large scale,
right,
you have to be prepared to let other people contribute and not try to control everything in the same way. Wright was somebody who really did enjoy designing everything. And he would make a lot of these outrageous claims, you know, boy, I was really a Leonardo da Vinci in that one, 'cause I was controlling everything. And he, when he designed, you know, we referenced the Imperial Hotel, he designed everything. He designed the building, the furniture, down to the silverware. You know, he really enjoyed, and when he would design for his houses, you know, a lot of people realize that, you know, he would he would design the furniture in kind of embedded in the wall. So you actually
get
rid of everything. And you would really, you know, basically surrender yourself to living in Wright's vision. But, you know, you can't, you know, and I think that's where too many times you see people trying to control the environment. You really have to be able to let things go at that scale, which is an important idea of thinking about how Wright, he was really trying, going back to it, what was he trying to do? He really was trying to take a lot of his little ideas together and make a big idea. You know, he was trying to create something bigger. You know, so of course he's got all these philosophies about single family lifestyle, the mile high skies, you know, the really tall skyscrapers out in the landscape. Let's put these together into one big vision, and hopefully somebody will buy into this and start to build, you know, the Broadacre City, which was his model.
But of course, as we know, even though he designed a lot of furniture and highly specific things, highly detailed things in the house in terms of sort of what's going to be in the house and what isn't, in Wright houses that are owned privately and people live in privately, do they still follow the Wright dictum of what sort of Wright with a W dictum of what sort of furniture you need to have in there, right? It's their house. They've done what they want with the interiors anyway.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it is a mixed bag. When you, talk to people about living in a Wright house, some people really fully embraced it and I think this goes back to, you know, how people reacted with him. He had so much charisma. The people that were connected with him, you know, probably I know, and I've talked to some people that have met him or, you know, he was he was a client of theirs. They really bought into that vision. And then there are people that buy, you know, people that look at Wright houses when they're up for sale. And I think people either want to be part of that vision or not.
You know,
there's certainly not a place you feel inspired to bring, another piece of furniture into, you know, you really want to kind of buy into the whole aesthetic. And I think Wright.
Oh, so bringing something from the outside in sort of ruins the aesthetic. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I think you kind of feel like you want to buy into the whole vision, kind of hook, line, and sinker, in that way.
And I think, and this is so telling, because as you and I were planning this show, Lady Buzzkill was with us. We were sitting at a coffee shop talking about it, and she said several times that Wright houses are famously unlivable. I mean, of course, every time we go on the housing market, try to buy houses, you know, she refuses to buy Wright houses, even though I want one.
Well, and people have criticized, have criticized a lot of the things that he was doing for contrast. That the roofs were very flat. They tend to leak. There's a reason why roofs were steep. So a lot of times people are very critical of Wright because they say fundamentally, you're building shelter and he wasn't doing that. There's real criticism. And it is interesting because when you look back in going back centuries into historic architecture, a lot of the reason why architecture looks the way it does is that there's fundamentally a climatic reason like areas that have snowfall have certain roof shapes and things like that, when you started getting to the modern movement, what happened was the technology allowed you to overcome some of the climatic things that were going on around you to make for some very interesting roof forms and shapes that may be counter to what may be the most sustainable direction to go.
Oh, so even a lower pitched roof is now stronger because of the undergirding or whatever than it used to be, so it could handle snowy
winter. Yeah, they could do these really, really broad overhangs with different kinds of materials. And Wright was able to push, cantilevers, for example, you were to go with this falling water house, which is one of his most recognizable ones. He was able to do things that historically were maybe not only conceived, but maybe probably not even possible.
I think that what's one of the things that's so fascinating about this idea of, having sort of not instructions, but sort of an aesthetic vision for how people should live in his houses is fascinating because it goes against what he often said in a lot of these interviews. And that is his ideas and his designs were the most democratic because they were the most close to the ground. They were the most natural, but yet he is sort of dictating to them what he wants in his own houses, designed houses, I should say, in their houses.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because you keep coming back to it and it's been very well documented that he really did have a colossal ego. But cities are, a lot more, democratic that way. And certainly, successful city designers understood that together it's people's voices and a really good city designer understood that it's a lot of people contribution. Mm-hmm. That's the true American way.
Okay. Cause we often think of cities as, especially 20th century cities, they look totalitarian. Some of the worst ones look Stalinistic.
Exactly.
But when you live in an apartment in the city, you're not told to live with this type of furniture. Whereas if you're living in a Wright house, you're sort of made to feel that way out in the suburbs.
It is very, very much it's certainly kind of an interesting contradiction, that way.
Well, there are a lot of contradictions in this, and we're going to get to one of the biggest contradictions, one of the biggest myths, one of the biggest godlike myths in terms of Frank Lloyd Wright's career, right after this word from our very important domestic partners at EcoSoap Bank. Back in a minute.
Well, Scalers, are you aware that global hygiene is in your hands? The people at EcoSoap Bank are aware of it. Clean water, proper sanitation, and personal cleanliness are among the most important factors in keeping poor families healthy in the developing world. Yet, 75% of rural families in Cambodia lack access to the most basic hygiene products, including soap. So EcoSoap Bank is doing something about it. They partner with hotels and guest houses in Cambodia to collect the partially used bars of soap left behind by the estimated 3 to 4 million tourists that pass through that country each year. The discarded, non-biodegradable bars are purified and recycled into new soap bars that are then distributed to rural schools, clinics, and slum areas. To date, the EcoSoap Bank has recycled 26,000 pounds of soap and served 667,000 people through its distribution program and its hygiene classes. The Buzzkill Institute is committed to helping this great project by contributing $1 for every Buzzkiller who donates to the EcoSoap Bank. Go to ecosoapbank.org/donate and type Buzzkill, 2 Z's and 2 L's, in the comments section of the online donation form. A donation of just $25 provides soap and hygiene education for 250 Cambodians, recycles 35 pounds of soap from the hospitality industry, and it supports ongoing employment of local people in Cambodia. It's as easy as that, Buzzkillers. A simple act to fill a basic need.
All right, here we are back upstairs talking with Eric Oss about Frank Lloyd Wright, the history of Frank Lloyd Wright, the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, and of course the myths about Frank Lloyd Wright. We mentioned Falling Water before we went down for a break, and it's certainly his most famous, or one of his most famous buildings, and probably the most famous myths seem to come out of this building, or the ideas behind it and the history behind it. What are some of the ways in which the designing, the building of Falling Water feed into a lot of these bigger myths about Wright thinking he's a god, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
This one for me is one of the most entertaining, you know, and it certainly is one that has been deep in the Frank Lloyd Wright folklore. I've toured the Falling Water House. They certainly mention it there.
Yeah.
And again, this is again one where it's certainly this myth certainly happened. And it's the myth that he designed it, it's that he designed it in 3 hours, you know, is the story. So I think this is always an interesting one that kind of let's back this one up a bit, you know, here for a minute.
Yeah. But first of all, we need to remind the Buzzkillers where it is. And
yeah.
All that
let's talk about all these things. So first of all, let's go back to the foundation of Wright. Is he was very famous for being an extremely hard worker. He was one of the masters, as we've talked about. But you know, he was famous for, you know, throwing himself into his work and working long hours. So, you know, again, you know, to get to a master status, you need to earn it. And he certainly put the time in, you know, this is a guy that was well known for that. Then let's fast forward, you know, to the 20s, he's come back from Europe. He's trying to rebuild his practice, but at the same time in the 1920s, he feels like he's being underappreciated and his competitors are just killing it. You know, in the 1920s, the cities are being filled with skyscrapers and, you know, all these things are going on and he's got a few commissions, you know, that he's moving along. And one of the things that, with his, I guess this is eventually his third wife, is the idea, Olga Vanna had the idea of creating the Taliesin Fellowship.
Okay. The Taliesin Fellowship. This is one of the biggest things in Wright history. What is it? What was it?
Yeah. And I think this was actually probably one of the brilliant ideas that, that Olga Vanna brought to his career and probably was the place where Wright was maybe the most comfortable. You know, it was the idea that, you know, he really started kind of remarketing himself, repositioning his prairie school work. And, he put out this opportunity for people to come to Spring Green, Wisconsin, and study at the foot of the master, but you would actually pay. You'd pay to be part.
Yeah, right.
By the way, this started years of abuse in the world of architecture of labor abuses. You know, who knows?
We do that at the institute too. So,
so people applied for the opportunity to do this. Then they wrote. Not only that, they paid. As a fellow at the Taliesin Fellowship, you would actually go tend the fields. You would build, you know, additions to the building. You would work, and you'd help, you know, get food ready for preparation. You know, I mean,
these are young architects.
These are young architects, and a part of it for him was that this was the complete life, and every evening they would sit and listen to Wright talk about architecture, so they get a chance to again sit at the foot of the master. But at the same time, he didn't have a lot of work, so part of it was building.
You mean a lot of commissions, to work on, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
plenty of work around the
digging potatoes. Although he refers to this as kind of the Jeffersonian idea of democratic aristocracy.
Good point. Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And then he had them build the building of which they were going to work in. You know, he built, you know, wing of the school. You know, so he definitely had a lot of folks working for him that were ready to work. And again, these were people that applied and they were talented folks. So they were just, you know, they were revving their engines for the chance to show Wright what they could do on the design and to really participate. So sure enough, he gets an application from Edgar Kaufman Jr. The son of the head of the Kaufman's department store. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Which was a huge and very profitable business.
And very profitable business. Kaufman was not wanted to have a kind of house outside of Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was a bit of a smoky city in that day, of course, as
Kaufman,
we know today.
It's the elder Kaufman.
The elder, right. And we know that Pittsburgh's a beautiful city today.
Partly because of your work at Urban Design Association.
Sure, certainly hope so. But Kaufman wanted to build a house outside the city and couldn't didn't want to build one I don't think he was able to build one in Ligonier, which was the place where most of them were building. And he had some family land in Bear Run.
Right.
And there was a beautiful...
How far is that outside of town?
About an hour and a half outside of Pittsburgh.
Okay, so certainly reachable even in the old car days.
Right, exactly. And people would... Yeah, he would drive out there. Now, when Kaufman applied, he knew... he knew who his father was, but his father was a big fan of Wright.
Oh, so Edgar Sr. was a big fan. I always thought that Edgar Jr. had introduced... Wright as an idea to Edgar Sr.
That's a good question. We should probably look into that a little deeper. But I don't know. But I think I remember that his father actually knew of Wright. But when they did connect and he invited Wright out to design his family home at Bear Run.
Okay.
So Wright, asked him quite a bit about where he spent most of his time, and that's where kind of the legacy of, well, we like to picnic, along the creek side. So,
just so the buzzkillers know, we're talking about two Kaufmans here. The younger Kaufman is the one who's studying at Taliesin. And the older Kaufman is the one who's bringing Wright out and asking him these questions. Where do you want? Okay.
Yeah. And Kaufman Sr. Was very much talked very evocatively about how much they loved the creek, runs through. And
it is very beautiful.
It's a beautiful
small waterfalls and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
very idyllic.
Beautiful part of Pennsylvania as well. It's a beautiful kind of rolling countryside. So Wright goes back to Taliesin, and many of the fellows who have been waiting for this opportunity for so long kept asking him, "Oh, when are we going to design? When are we going to design?" So he's, it's interesting because. You think to yourself, maybe, and again, this is where we're looking at things critically, but there's no real evidence of this. But when you think about it, Wright's got a talented group of people and he needs to stay in front of them. How do you control that discussion? And that is that, you really want, and how do you then also at the same time really make sure you stay in front of the design?
Okay.
So Wright was now again, this is, if you read, there's a book, and we'll put it on the bookshelf for folks to look at. There's the Fellowship, a book where there's a couple of memoirs that actually corroborate this, that apparently Wright was not hanging out as much with folks during the write up leading up until Kaufman arrived to look at the design for Falling Water.
So he may have locked himself in his study.
Maybe.
Okay.
So you never know. Or at least, he's thinking through it. Now, so Wright, so sure enough, this is the famous part of the story starts coming into play, that Wright is, sure enough, Kaufman has arrived in Chicago. He's 3 hours from Spring Green. Are you going to design? And people kept pushing him and he kept saying, nope, the time is not right. The time is not right. And so sure enough, with 3 hours, before he arrives, Wright says, "I'm ready for paper," or whatever it was. And then he sat at a table and he started drafting in front of the fellows. Now, rumor has it again also that he started drawing from left to right and drew the house that way.
Okay.
Any architect knows that's not really the way you draw. You draw something that's kind of has very distinct measurements. You kind of create some guidelines and some framework, and then you build the drawing that way. But nevertheless, even if he was designing at that speed, he would have more than likely, he probably had it either committed to memory or something.
Right.
So sure enough, Wright spends those 3 hours in this kind of very, very quick design, session, gets the building designed right at the moment that apparently the timing was just right, that he finished the drawing and then Kaufman walks in the door and he rolls it, walks over to him, shakes his head. He said, "We've been waiting for you." That's the legacy and the myth. And sure enough, several times it's interesting because when you talk to people about Frank Lloyd Wright, they say, "Oh, I've heard that he could design from moving from left to right and he could just, and it would just come to him and that sort of thing.
Crank it out in no time at all.
But when you and again, I think this is again where Wright is seizing a moment to market is that sure enough, a lot of the fellows immediately they recognize, okay, this guy's on a completely different level than we are to conceive what he conceived at that moment. And it was a very innovative house. It had...
Okay, so what we're saying is the 3 hours, the drawing it in 3 hour story isn't, might be a myth, certainly sounds like a myth, but actually the design is not, we're not being critical of design, it's just quite brilliant.
Yeah, okay. the design was quite brilliant. And at the time, again, there was a lot of other architects that were starting to experiment with those kind of shapes and houses. And he kind of, in some ways, really put it in a very meaningful way. And he cantilevering over the water is a very, you know, obviously an incredible innovation. And that house is almost impossible to imitate, you know.
And we have pictures of this on the website for the Buzzkillers. It is very beautiful. I've been there many, many times.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things that he was doing. Both he was taking his context and doing something that was a very strong reaction to what was around him.
The waterfall and things like that.
And at the same time, he was also, you know, kind of controlling the situation and being able to position himself as the master and leading the design. And that's what he did throughout his career, is making sure that, you know, he was leading the design and leading the vision, both with the clients and with the people around him. And that.
So are we saying, are we saying that he didn't think of the fellowship, the Taliesin Fellowship, as a sort of way to help bring young architects up and into the profession? He was thinking of it as a way, because he didn't collaborate much with them, he was thinking of it as a way, just, I'm going to have all these worshipers or acolytes, or is that too harsh a distinction?
Well, it's interesting to look back on the fellowship itself. I think there were moments, from what I understand, there were moments that were very collaborative, but oftentimes what he was trying to do is position himself at the early phases and the kind of crystal of the idea and let them to continue to follow.
Okay.
All right. Now the fellowship had all kinds of depth and very interesting characters that were part of it, and some of which, you know, he really owed his life to. Literally, one of the fellows who was involved with fellowship from very early days all the way up until recently, I think he passed away recently. He actually at one point Wright was broke, and he actually had a considerable amount of wealth and was able to actually owned all of Taliesin. He owned Wright, you know. If he wanted to, he could have just said, "Okay, listen, Frank. there's a new boss in town.
Spend more time on your drawings."
Yeah. So you know, the fellowship saved him, but the fellowship also made him, because I think a lot of folks, you know, knew that by joining it, they were doing this to work in his environment, in an environment that he created and he designed for them.
So do you think that this is important to write? Is he consciously, we can't know whether he's consciously doing it, but is he making connections between the, if you will, intellectual demands of design with the intellectual and working demands of marketing?
I think in some ways it's a very similar thought process. And again, this is probably my philosophical ideas about this.
We're talking about Wright's philosophy, talking about yours.
when you're designing, you're consciously reacting to your context. So for example, and we were just talking about falling water, Wright was specifically had chosen to engage this house or get as close to the creek as he could and the waterfall. And even if he had decided to locate the house somewhere else, that would be a conscious design decision, is that he was considering what was going on around him. And that's what design is. You get feedback and you get input in your design process, and then you turn that into something wonderful and something interesting. Now, marketing in some ways is a very similar thought process. You can't market in a vacuum. You have to be reacting to a context and then trying to position things and move things forward in a brilliant way. We used to see that in shows like Mad Men and things like that. If Wright were in Mad Men, he would be Don Draper.
I wonder what he would do with Twitter.
right. And it is interesting that you just mentioned the kind of today's embracing new forms of media. And we talked about this a little bit in the show, is that Wright was eager to capitalize on that, to, you know, being out in the TV and out on the television was a chance to reach a whole new group of people.
Which he did.
And at the time, you know, you think about this, the world is, was just changing significantly, And there was this explosion of abilities to market and abilities to reach new people and so many people.
Right, millions of people. And what's so fascinating about the way this all ends up is we talk so much at the Institute and on our various episodes about the importance of historical context, taking these out of context, about the enormous number of complications that get flattened by sort of the History Channel steamrolling of history, and that they need to be revived, and we need to show people how complicated things were. But on the other hand, Wright kept talking about simplicity, getting away from the Victorian over-ornamentation. And so, you know, by looking at his simplicity and his changes, we also have to look at the complications.
Absolutely. He was able to really kind of turn his weaknesses into strengths, and he was able to reposition himself as a superhuman designer and moving the world forward, you know, and leading. So that kind of helped him position himself as a master, and at the same time, it made you feel connected to him. You know, and I think that's something that's interesting. Is that there were so many things by saying that he was involved with innovations in the single family home was a way for you to kind of think that you're connected to Wright, or, you know, and by the fact that he had influence on, say, the ranch house, you know, you see ranch houses everywhere.
Yeah.
So whenever you hear about these things, they're all things again that maybe by positioning himself as such a master, that this man, this artist, influenced my life and allowed you to feel connected to him.
Because after all, there are some other famous architects. You can't live in a Calatrava house. You can't live in an I.M. Pei house because there aren't any of them, very few of them. But you can live in a house that's very much like a Franklin,
very much like Wright, and certainly influenced by Wright. One of my graduate thesis was to work on a project that would be a new context for one of Wright's absolute last projects, Marin County Civic Center in Marin County. And
all right.
I did a lot of research, and apparently he was in a car, and the production, the local architect had said that Wright was sitting next to him in the car. And when he looked out the window and he saw all the suburbs, he said, "Look at all that. I'm responsible for all of this." You know, so somehow, you know, he kept saying things over and over again in order to, so that no matter what, whenever you looked out the window, you would think that you were somehow connected to Wright. So that was his real brilliance, was to really design his legacy and to turn those weaknesses into real opportunities for him, and make a career that connected to everyone.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. He connected in this way, and by connecting in this way, he helped create
the American dream.
Yeah, and then he could talk about how he helped create the American dream to impressionable people driving him around. But we need to remember about the context and the complications, even though the simplicity is what Wright was trying to strive for, or at least trying to project in a marketing sense. So I'm going to go down to the marketing department at the Institute here and give them new marching orders about how to improve our low profile into a very high Wrightian profile. And it only remains for me to thank Eric for so much he's done here today and so much illumination he's given us about Frank Lloyd Wright. So thanks. And when are we going to have you on the show again?
Hopefully soon.
That'd be great. I'm sure the Buzzkillers are going to want to hear more. Talk to you next week.
Peppercast.